Hello, and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast, presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshimworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. Today, we're continuing our investigation into the ways that AI is informing ecosystems across industry and society, and exploring how we design pathways to resilient futures.
I'm Ed Powell, CEO of TensorX, where we leverage the cloud, the crowd, and AI to inform strategy, drive innovation, and optimize performance. And today, I'm joined by my co-host, James Villarubia. Hello, James.
Hi, Ed. Well, hello, everyone. My name is James Villarubia. I'm a Presidential Innovation Fellow with NASA, where I help the scientists and engineers at NASA integrate AI into their everyday work. Back to you, Ed.
Thanks, James. Today, we're welcoming Amrit Kazem, co-CEO of Holistic AI, which is one of the hottest startups in AI, working to empower enterprises to adopt and scale AI with confidence. Welcome, Amrit.
Thanks, Ed. Hi, James. It's just fantastic to be here.
Throughout the season that we've had guests who have been working in AI for decades, with your educational background in chemistry and then a doctorate in philosophy and joining the space within the last 10 years, how did you make it into the AI world?
It's an interesting one, actually. As you mentioned, I actually did my undergraduate in chemistry. I was studying at University College London, and I was very much interested in science. And the branch of chemistry I was interested in was physical chemistry. So I kind of maintained that passion. And then I went on actually to start a postgraduate in, at the time, there was this kind of huge hype cycle around nanotechnology. So there was this lots of interest in carbon nanotubes. People were looking for these kind of applications. It was supposed to be this super material that we were going to put into kind of the wings of planes. They were going to be these superconductors. They had like the highest Poisson ratio in known to nature and so on and so forth. So there's this kind of flood of capital into that space. And I started a PhD in this space. And I just knew I wasn't really that interested in the day-to-day kind of science. So at that point, I thought to myself, you know what, I'm better off bailing at this point rather than later on in life. And I switched over, and I actually was working at the same time, and I did a master's in philosophy. So I moved back to London, and the philosophy master's was really just a kind of passion project. I was always interested in the subject. And I wasn't motivated just to study philosophy of science or philosophy of technology, but more general philosophy. So it went really well. One of my supervisors was like, look, Emre, you've really got to do a PhD in the subject. So I ended up doing a PhD in conscience. I was actually interested in the kind of moral, when you get haunted by feelings of guilt and morality, and you have that kind of voice inside, and to ask questions about how rational that is, whether or not we should respect that voice, or whether or not we should kind of curtail it. So it was deeper questions about consciousness, more specifically moral self-consciousness, that's in the form of conscience itself. And I was interested in it from a historical perspective. So I ended up doing my PhD in Kant, Immanuel Kant's philosophy of conscience. And anyway, yeah, I was really motivated by that. So by a kind of series of accidents, I ended up moving into the AI space. So I had finished my PhD in philosophy, as I mentioned, and actually I had a very good friend who was really getting into this kind of new technologies, etc. And he said to me, look, Emre, if you put $10 in, you get $1,000 out. And I said, look, it just sounds like a scam to me. He said, there's this thing called Bitcoin. And I said, oh God, another kind of Ponzi scheme or something absurd like that. So like all foolish academics, instead of putting money in, because I think he was right, actually, if I put $10 in, then I would have made a lot of money now. Instead of doing that, I ended up reading on some of the kind of foundational texts in the space. And then it kind of triggered lots and lots of questions about, okay, the whole kind of thesis in that space was about how these new digital technologies, or specifically blockchain, was going to mediate value exchange. And I was thinking about, well, what is value exchange in the context of a society? It's usually via taxation. We pay some tax, and then at the end of it, what we get is, I don't know, roads, police, an army, and so on and so forth. So I ended up just speculatively writing an article about how new digital technologies were impacting the social contract. And because traditional technologies don't, traditional technologies, non-digital ones, they respect jurisdiction, they're regional and so on and so forth. These things just don't respect any of that. And they're just so kind of radical and quick. So I ended up writing an article on that. And then that article got picked up by a mathematician in the computer science department. And she said, hey, look, Emra, because I knew her from when I was an undergraduate in chemistry, and it's been like 10, 15 years had passed. And she said, oh, I thought you were a scientist. And I said, well, things happen over that period. And she said, look, we're really interested in this problem of AI ethics. And we're engineers and we're motivated by this problem. And we really do want to do something about it. And we know that we need non-engineers in this space. But we're having lots of problems with the lawyers and the sociologists from the other kind of faculties who don't really have an understanding of the engineering or the maths behind it. So she said, would you be up for just working in this experimental space? And I was like, hell yeah, would love to do that. So I ended up in the computer science department. It was super experimental, really kind of interesting space. So lots of things kind of emerged out of that context. So it was an accidental journey into AI, but it has just been a phenomenal kind of experience.
Yeah. So I love that story. It's a not common story in the AI community to have someone who sort of was deep into a field that is not engineering related and then to come into AI so late and then have such an impact in the community as holistic AI is right now. Can you talk about the sort of that second half of the journey? So you are in the AI space, you're doing sort of early AI experimental stuff. AI, sort of the large language models that we and ChatGPT stuff that has come out in the last year or so hadn't blown up yet. But now we're at this moment where sort of a lot of that philosophy work, a lot of that sort of experimental work and ethics work is now really coming to a head with holistic AI. Can you explain sort of what the company does and sort of how it got to this problem space?
Yes, very much so. Actually, what I would say, look, the mission of the company, when we state it, is to empower enterprises to adopt and scale AI with confidence. So what we were trying to solve at the core of it was the problem of trust. So like all of these kind of technologies, the only way in which we can have mass adoption or we can maximize the use of these technologies is very much through people being confident in them. And actually what we had was there were two horns to this bull. One horn was this sense of, hey, there's this radical technology. It's an industrial revolution. You'd have to be a dummy for not using it. So every single morning, the CEO opens up their newspaper and they're just seeing AI here, AI there. And they're like, look, they're running around. They're telling their C-suite, what are we doing about this? Now, the other side of the story is, gosh, over and over again, we have lots and lots of high profile cases of incidences where AI has gone terribly wrong. So like what, for example, something that motivated us pretty early on was we were looking at trading algorithms. And you can imagine the kind of consequences of a trading algorithm glitching or going wrong. It was so important. Actually, we had a very famous case study of a trading algorithm glitching for a fraction of a second and bankrupting the company. I think it wiped off some close enough to $500 million. And actually, that's when a lot of the work that we were doing, these high-profile cases of these incidences, were motivating not just commercial interest, but also state interest. So it was off the back of that that, let's say, the Bank of England in the UK came to us and said, look, what about how would we approach the systemic risks to the economy for trading algorithms starting to herd or glitch and so on and so forth? So there were other incidences. So, for example, there was very famous use of a well-known company, which I won't name, had to retire an algorithm that they were using to sieve CVs. They were using the AI to, you can imagine, hundreds of thousands of people applying for a job, and then it just sieves these CVs, it just excludes women, and the people are like, oh, hang on a minute, horrible bias. And then you had these kind of algorithms being used in credit scoring and saying it was a husband and wife. It's exactly the same, let's say, characteristics. The only difference is one is male, one is female, and she's being given worse terms. So you had insurance algorithms. So we've had examples where you can imagine how sensitive health and life insurance is. So you had a huge amount of incidences. And that's the second half of it. That's the second horn of the bull. So what we've got here is, one hand, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. If you don't adopt these technologies, this AI, then the companies won't remain competitive. I mean, you're remaining in a pre-industrial state, if you will. But as soon as you adopt these technologies, you introduce these kind of existential threats into the business. So what was happening? People were saying, okay, how can we be confident about these systems? And that's where we started to think about things like certification, assurance, auditing, and so on and so forth. So what we did, actually, how we ended up doing this commercially was, as academics, we thought about what are the methods we would develop to interrogate algorithms. And we thought, okay, let's develop some kind of AI auditing techniques. How do we audit algorithms? And then I can talk about maybe, yeah, if you're interested in what that actually means. But that's actually how we got going. And then really we were like, this is way too important to remain as some kind of research project. And then we just spun the company out. And I can talk a little bit about how we do that at scale and systematically. But yeah, really the problem that we were trying to solve was one of trust.
I really like those anecdotes. I think it sort of reflects what a lot of political scientists and historians will tell you about sort of all policy and regulation is that they're written in blood. OSHA regulations, they are written in blood. Someone had to get hurt for us to say back and say, hey, maybe this should be a rule. You're not allowed to do X. It's sort of interesting to see that being applied in an AI context sort of today, because there's so much new stuff. I guess my question to you is, I mean, the cybersecurity community, as maybe an analog, has taken a long time to get its head around what is a good certification. We've iterated on these a lot. They're still changing. The whole system is to sort of build up and agree. The community had to sort of establish its own understanding of what was good enough to establish trust. But AI is so new, particularly sort of, or at least it's not new, but the AI certification, the need for it is so new, given sort of the commercial pressure. And I think that comes with a lot of debate or distrust. Well, is this certification real? Like, is it enough? Can you talk to me and sort of share with our audience a little bit about sort of what's the current ecosystem sort of like? Is there trust? Like, how much of this is a moving target? And I know you mentioned the Bank of England. I know there's probably different experiences from a regulatory standpoint from like particular states in the US to the US as a whole, the federal government to the UK as sort of operating as an institution. I mean, how is that ecosystem sort of shaped by the regions and the population and politics of those spaces?
A phenomenal question. Actually, it's become that kind of global question is really at the heart of all of this. So what I'll do is I'll probably just start off and just explain a little bit about the different kind of ecosystems and how they're approaching it. And then I'll talk more about what we're seeing here in the US. So in the first instance, what we have in Europe, in the EU in particular, is a horizontal approach to regulations and standards. So it's very centralized. Actually, the EU AI Act was passed last year. And what we're seeing at the moment is different kind of bodies in just kind of really dotting the I's and crossing the T's. And that is, the AI Act is the equivalent of the General Data Protection Regulation, the GDPR, which is, again, horizontal piece of legislation that's cross-sector and cross-jurisdiction. So that, we think, is probably going to become the global de facto standard for the regulatory questions. What we have in the UK is a much more sector-specific approach. So different kind of sectors have different approaches. So the health sector, the health regulator has a different approach to the information regulator, to the Bank of England, and so on and so forth. So putting aside Europe and the UK, the US is super, notwithstanding what normally people try to caricature the US as somehow behind, actually the US is super active in this space. And we've got three levels of activity. At the highest level, let's say the federal level, there's lots and lots of activity taking place. Probably the most important of which was the executive order that was pretty much drafted by NIST. And that was I was actually in DC for that in October. And that kind of sets this
not that long ago. Yeah. We're dealing with it now from the agency side. Yeah. So it's live.
Yeah. And we anticipate that probably in the same way as the NIST framework became, even though notwithstanding it was voluntary, became the de facto standard in cybersecurity. We think it's going to be the same thing in AI. But we've also got different kind of federal agencies interested in this. So I know the NTIA, who, forgive me, I hadn't heard of before engaging with them, are very much active in this space. And we know, for example, the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, are interested in this problem. I actually met with the commissioner while I was in DC, and there was a real concern of saying, okay, we're using AI in really ethically sensitive ways, and we're going to make sure that we do this in an appropriate way. So there's federal level activity. And then there's a lot of state-level activity. So, for example, California, as you can imagine, the two coasts are really kind of battling it out on here. California actually proposed a kind of Algorithm Accountability Act. I think it's going to take a long time before it actually comes to fruition. But already, they've already tabled things like the Workplace Technology Act, and they've made amendments to existing regulation, which make AI relevant in that particular context. And of course, we can see different kind of activities taking place in the East Coast. Then at the local level, it's also taking place. So for example, Colorado have a specific piece of legislation that mandates bias audits for the use of AI in the insurance sector. New York City local law mandates bias audits for the use of AI in determining whether candidates are moved forward or excluded from particular positions. So, and you can also imagine there's a lot of activity in sensitive areas like make dual use, procurement, export, and so on and so forth. So it's quite a strange thing. When I was an academic and I really started looking at this problem, even pre-ChatGPT, etc., I realized there's a tremendous amount of activity taking place in the US. And part of it, and I'll just kind of close with this, is there seems to be a kind of path dependency that determines where someone gets to and how they approach this. So in Europe, it was the kind of data people who went on to say, hey, we're going to introduce this AI Act. And what I notice in my conversations here in the States is very much the kind of cybersecurity people who are saying, hey, how are we going to get a hold of this? So I think it's going to be a mix of both. The way that the cybersecurity industry emerged, so incidences get kind of learnt about and cascaded quickly across the industry, best practice emerges through industry, and so on and so forth, and benchmarks get kind of solidified over time. So that's where they say cybersecurity experience will probably be replicated. But I think the data governance side will also be replicated in terms of documentation, things like consent, you know, ensuring that people understand where when they're interacting with an AI and what data is being used in their training of the systems and so on and so forth. So we've got a real kind of huge amount of activity here, and it's just really heating up, and it's super interesting to see the US on the front foot on this.
One thing you said that sort of stuck out to me, I just want to sort of reflect on, was this idea that, I mean, I don't know, when you read about AI and regulations in the news, I think there's a lot of panic of like, oh man, we are headed in, it's like the lights are off, we're stumbling around in the dark. But it's so interesting that you spoke about that, like a lot of states, not federal government, well, federal government is moving, that states are really just adapting existing laws around bias to say, hey, yeah, and also AI, and that we aren't really starting from scratch, as I think many people are freaked out about, panicked by, but we're really just, I think, applying a burden of proof to say, hey, if you're going to do this thing, you used to do it with a spreadsheet, now you're doing it with AI, the burden of proof for trust is still there. You can't sort of get around it because, oh, magical hand wave, oh, it's an AI now. So I mean, it sounds like we actually have a bit of a firmer footing than maybe people realize. I mean, is that fair to say?
So a question more generally for both yourself and Ed is, we're talking about institutions, NASA and so on, that have been at the forefront of not just technological innovation and adoption. So I'm sure there's already pretty robust kind of governance procedures in place. So actually, I'm curious about, so what we're seeing is that the industry is not quite sure where to place this. Who does it kind of fall under? Which persona does it? Is it the data? Is it the CIO? Is it the CTO? Is it the legal function? And I think it's interesting to see, I think what we're seeing right now is, where does one place this technology? But actually, just I'm curious about your experiences in a very forward, really innovative company and institution. How the kind of risk management was, how are you seeing the AI, if you will, kind of stack falling under?
We look all the time at, and our primary statement is that there are no solutions in the world, only trade-offs. So everything we look at, the question really comes back to, okay, we're going to have more safety, but at what cost? Is it the cost of manipulation? Is it the cost of lack of innovation? If you look at businesses that are billion-dollar market cap in Europe, they're on average 100 years old. In the U.S., they're 20 years old because the U.S. system is much more accustomed to risk and disruption and fragility. It's kind of baked in for the system to be anti-fragile, not for any individual entity to be anti-fragile. And so what happens, and so I think what would be interesting is if you look at the states that are implementing it, I doubt it's Texas. I think it's probably California and Massachusetts. And those would be the more European states of the U.S., right? So I think it's interesting because I think it's a fascinating question because you want to establish trust, but how then would we deal with the same issue with Bitcoin, right? Because do we have a state superstructure for Bitcoin? Well, no. Why isn't it regulated? And what's going to happen? Well, you're going to move your AI machines to the Caymans. You're going to do something where it's not going to be covered by the regulation. And so I think it's a fascinating, I mean, I love what you're doing. I think it's a fascinating problem. We think about this all the time because in a system where there's kind of, we leverage rockets typically to try to do this. But how do you leverage market forces? Well, you could do it with regulation. You could also do it through plaintiffs' firms. If you've been wronged, in the U.S., we have contingency fee law firms. They can come and you pay nothing. In Europe, they haven't liked that. They'd rather just regulate it than to do that. So it's a trade-off question that I think is really a very profound one and a very important one to be discussed and to really look at a broad set of possible ways to address it. And I think in the U.S., we tend to be a little more suspicious of the government. We have things called the Twitter files and all that. We're a little more suspicious of the government. And so we're like, who's going to decide? Who's going to be the ultimate trusted agent that says this is trustworthy? And is it centralized or is it decentralized? And what are those entities' self-interests in doing that? Because once, if I'm Microsoft and I can say I have OpenAI, and it's the be trusted one, that all of a sudden I have a monopoly.
I guess, Ed, unlike you, I am not so much worried about sort of moving models to the Cayman Islands because I know how expensive land is in the Cayman Islands relative to the amount of space that you need to train some of these models. I guess I'm coming at it from to your original question. What I'm seeing is sort of a gap between, call it the technology and the version of AI that is blowing up right now and the regulations and the understanding of AI that existed prior to 2023. And that it's sort of interesting to see a lot of discussions around, oh, well, we've got to make sure our data is trained on unbiased data, that we've done a lot of data cleaning. We understand that. And so what's interesting is, like, to me, is like, well, I don't know of anyone who's like training their own large language model. There are 5 base models right now. I suspect there might be 6 total ever. And they were just going to build on top of those. And so this new generation of large language models that everyone is, you know, excited by, there are only a few companies that have the scale to train something which takes like billions of dollars to build and do yourself and maintain over time. And I just can't see that if everyone's not going to do that, then everyone's not going to be deciding what that input data is. They're just going to build on top of it, sort of layers on top of that model. And that really changes the ecosystem, the nature of that auditability. And I'm seeing sort of a gap in that understanding of like, oh, well, you can't control what goes into the training. Now, what do you do for auditability? Now, what do you do? You can't understand the model because it's too complex. The traceability and understandability is now beyond you. So I want to throw it back to you, Emre. I mean, I'm seeing that sort of shift. How is the auditability sort of context shaped for your customers as they are starting to think about these models that are really trained outside their organization and they sort of just buy off the shelf and have to sort of adapt? I mean, if you can't control what goes in, or if you're more correctly, is like, we know what went in and it's 600 million or a trillion pieces of information from across human writing, all of which was deeply biased, and some of it is very racist and sexist because it's the history of humanity and all of its faults baked into that writing, and now we've trained on it. So how do you deal with that in a sort of a post hoc analysis? Like, what is the trend there that you're seeing? And I'm confused as I'm trying to figure that out internally for teams that I'm working with.
So I think it's a fantastic question, and it's an interesting one because pre-LLMs, we still had arguments about certain technologies, certain AI systems being too complicated to know anything about, and so on and so forth. So probably the best way of thinking about it is dividing it into kind of 2 groups. One group is the vendors. So these are the ones that are kind of developing these technologies, selling these technologies, etc. So some of the kind of 4 or 5, as you said, in the LLM context, and more generally, the kind of AI, whoever's selling AI and they're using AI and a kind of broad vernacular to include everything outside of the LLMs as well. So them there, it very much is a kind of almost product safety. These are the documentation, and here is all the kind of paperwork that comes along with this kind of product. And then the second part is those who use and deploy these systems. So what we are interested in the second group is not the technology. We're not interested in controlling the technology. We're interested in controlling the harm. So you have to ask a basic question, such as if you're using a glorified Excel sheet, which we're still seeing to do kind of credit scoring or whatever, that's pretty sensitive. You want to know how that's impacting someone. But if you're using an LLM to generate, let's say, a kind of a word cloud that gets put into some kind of marketing campaign that someone might or might not consider, even though the technology is deeply unexplainable and so on and so forth, the use case is benign. So actually, the way we're approaching it in the first instance is how, what's the use case? Like, what is it actually being used for? And then after that, you kind of create the, let's say, the risk matrix off the back of it, or the risk assessment off the back of it. So there, the question about, so the specific question that you're describing, let's say, for example, about explainability, becomes relevant to what is it being explained for? So it could be, if it's ethically sensitive, let's say the issues of bias that you mentioned, we want to know how it's generating recommendations across different demographics. But you might want explainability because it's mission critical. So let's say it's a trading system and you're using it in a particular way, and it just, you might want to know why it's kind of trading in the particular way that it is. But that's not the same kind of explainability that you would have when you're concerned across different demographics. So what we've got is a kind of proportionality. The more complicated the system is, the less explainable it is, and the less you're able to interrogate and assure those kinds of systems. And then off the back of that, you make kind of judgments about how and where those kind of systems can be used. So a lot of the work is specifically with the LLMs is we have our own way of doing an audit on an LLM. Effectively, what we're doing is kind of bombarding the system with a whole bunch of kind of props, etc. And then we're kind of measuring and assessing the distribution of the outputs. But for different kinds of systems, we do different kinds of work. But really what we have is, one thing I want to push back on is, and it was happening even before LLMs, I remember it was a very senior politician that approached us and said, a video of mine has been removed from YouTube or whatever it was. I think they were being accused of some disinformation on COVID or something like that. And they were saying, I went to the vendor, you can guess who it is. And they said, oh, it's just too complicated. We have no idea. It just got automatically flagged. And I know that they have robust mechanisms of flagging things and so on and so forth. So what I want to talk about is that there's layers of this. So there may be a neural, but there's things like, where is it being used? How is it being used? What testing was done on it? How is it performed historically? There's a whole bunch of things that one can do without saying immediately throwing your hands up and saying, oh my God, it's just too complicated to investigate.
So it sounds like, I mean, to borrow from cybersecurity, the term sort of defense in depth is common in cybersecurity where, and for those who are not in the space, sort of you don't rely on one single protection. You have to look at the security system as multiple layers. So think Swiss cheese. If you layer up Swiss cheese, eventually all the holes will get blocked. I mean, it sounds like the approach that you were taking to this auditability is not like a one and done, oh, here's your score, but more of a, okay, we're going to look at it from this way. We're going to try this approach here. Oh, you're using an LLM here. So we have a different mechanism for evaluation for the LLM compared to what we might have for like a home trained model. I mean, is that fair that you've got sort of all these different considerations in your framework?
Absolutely. So sometimes it's really as basic as, so this is one of the first things I go and I, when I speak to a C-suite CEO, I ask, how many systems do you have? And usually they kind of look at me with a spooked face and they say, okay, look, first we got to do an inventory. We got to have a registry of these systems. We've got to know, have a single pane view of how these systems are being used across the business. And then secondly, what we do is you look at every single system. And it really is about just the kind of risk assessing, the context of use, and then the underlying technologies. So it is absolutely layered. And what you really want to do is good governance and coverage. So one of the things we were talking to a huge pharmaceutical company, and they were saying, look, Emma, we've got a lot of money to spend on legal and all the rest. We're not worried about ticking some box off. But what we are concerned about is Joe in research pulls out his credit card and just like downloads some system or plays around with something. And all of a sudden we've got this exposure to of our proprietary data or personal data. So we call it kind of shadow AI. So there's a tremendous amount of auditing and governance that's not super technical, if you will.
No, that's fascinating. And I get back to this question because I do think you hit it square in the middle of which is it's all about trust ultimately. And so creating this system of trust, what are the analogs? And the reason I kind of asked about and mentioned the Caymans earlier was because I was thinking trading, people who just did like regulation, where you just set up your trading operation in the Caymans, right? What do you think is the best analog? Like at the common era kind of language, like what would be the best? Is it a courtroom where you have witnesses that are testifying like the large language model is that you're cross-examining it? Or how do you think about it in a very kind of simplified, overarching way?
At the core, is a trust comes from confidence, and confidence comes from experience using these technologies over time. And a big part of this, it comes back to that question you were mentioning, why is the US so phenomenal innovation and deployment, is because you do it. So like my whole argument about good governance is going to come from the same ecosystem that innovated these technologies. So
right.
When you look at these studies and you see who is most worried about them, is it really proportionate to the distance from those who are developing and deploying those systems? So I am super confident that because we are, it all comes from here. It's extraordinary the amount of technology that's every few months something is happening, but the governance will also come from the same ecosystem. Maybe not the same people, but certainly because we know what's happening and we understand. So it's really just confidence comes from that experience, and that experience is only, if you will, a matter of time.
Yeah, and I do think that there's, again, more risk that the U.S. has historically been willing to take. I mean, James's point about OSHA, the OSHA regulations have resulted from some accidents that happened. And so when people are building pathways on their campuses, some people say, well, we're going to build the pathway and tell you where to go. Other people just wait and see where the paths get kind of worn in across the grass and then put the pathways in there. I think the U.S. has tended to be more the latter because they were more interested in having optimal pathways than they were in specifying them beforehand. So as we look ahead over the horizon, I see a little over the horizon radar here, what things should our audiences really be considering as they think about trust and the inherent risks as well as opportunities?
So for me, the overwhelming message is not to indulge the end of the world, the apocalyptic, the robots are taking over. I've got to make a plug for 2001, A Space Odyssey, without giving the kind of context of the podcast. It's the short-term harms. We're seeing like how AI is being used in very specific ways and how our companies are actually implementing this thing. So like when you see the big consultancies, and I was just listening to the CEO of Deloitte the other day talking about, look, this is a revolution in retraining, in broadly digital transformation. And so really to think about very tangibly how these systems are going to be used, playing with them, experimenting with them. I saw a chart the other day about the impact of the internet on general economy and productivity. And there was a time lag before it became transformative. And I think we're kind of in that phase now with AI, because it took a few years for people to say, well, what is this thing? And play around and normalize it. So really, the takeaways are to say, maybe not to speculate so much on the kind of bombastic questions about, are we going to reach super intelligence and are the robots taking over and all the rest of it? It really is that, where's just using AI in supply chain management, using AI in drug discovery. It's going to be much more those kind of tangible use cases.
Yeah, I love that sort of framing of sort of the internet and this sort of lag and change, because you can see that as it's not like the models today, GPT-4 versus 3.5 versus 3, even sort of the past year, while they've picked up, we've hit that S curve. The real shift was almost sort of binary. It's like, oh, it went from not acceptable to understandable and usable by the average person. And that is, I think, the cultural shift. But I mean, to your point about the Space Odyssey, I think like you could simplify your entire business and just have like one checkbox. It's like, does my AI have glowing red eyes or not? Because that is clearly the only indicator that matters. Like, oh, doesn't it has blue eyes, it must be safe. So, I mean, that's as a tip from one technologist to another. There you go.
Well, this has been fascinating. And actually, I think it's really important that we have people who have studied like conscience and trust and philosophy helping to inform how we actually create systems of trust and largely, hopefully, decentralized systems of trust that are not gameable. And I think it's been a fascinating discussion and a really important discussion. And we really appreciate not only you coming on and spending this time with us, but also just your work in this area. Because there's a lot of potential for productivity, but one, we have to have the models actually not hallucinate so much, and they have to be able to be trusted, both in terms of what they produce, but also in terms of the goodness of what they produce. James, what about you?
Yeah, I think I've really enjoyed our conversation, Emre, so thank you for joining us. The thing that's stuck out to me is really that comment about the state government sort of modifying existing law. And it's like, oh, we actually do that, sort of have an understanding of how to deal with this. We just need to sort of tweak it for the times. It gives me a lot of confidence. And the other piece at the very end you mentioned, and I think this one's going to be the earworm, is the concern around AI is sort of proportional to the distance from the system. And as someone who sort of lives very close to it, I guess I'm seeing that concern and seeing it in my ecosystem. But I don't think my wife, an interior designer, is as concerned and maybe more hopeful. And I think that's a good way to frame it, is like the distance from the system is maybe a good gut check for everyone out there who's on in our audience, who's maybe a little bit worried. Take a step back and ask the people on the street. So I'm gonna do that. So thank you.
Well, Simri, what are your thoughts?
I just couldn't agree more. One of the things I was thinking about the other day, we were talking about access to healthcare. An extraordinary result was the use of these AI in cataract scanning. Is better than the best consultants in the world. You literally go in there and it just scans your eye, costs next to nothing to do so, and it's as good as the best doctor in America doing so. But we've got the use of AI in drug discovery, modeling of protein folding. I'm just like, this is, as long as we do it right, this is a tremendous opportunity. What an extraordinary idea that you could effectively have a private tutor in every home. It is to really kind of balance this and say, we've got to get this right, absolutely, but it's also a tremendous opportunity. The way that we don't think about certain medieval diseases now, and they don't even occur in our consciousness. We don't say, oh God, we've got another cholera outbreak. I'm thinking about that these technologies can really be so transformative that there are things that we find troubling in society today that we're going to look back and say, oh yeah, it's just not serious. So I'm optimistic about these technologies. I'm optimistic about the destructiveness of them. When we look at humanity as a whole, hundreds of millions of people living in poverty, hundreds of millions of people don't get access to education. So we can make this a positive story, and I'm confident that it will.
Well, it's been great having the time with you too. And as you say, I think the key issue is always goes back to systems of trust. And we appreciate the work that you're doing in helping all the participants in this ecosystem understand and have trust in all the technologies that we live every day.
Thank you. A real honor.
Thanks again, everyone, for joining us today. And please do check out this season's new episodes to join our discovery journey as we explore the AI arena, pressure testing hype versus reality, and understanding where practical applications of these capabilities are shaping ecosystemic futures. Follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite place to access podcasts. And you can always learn more at shushumworks.com.